Welcome to Season 11, Episode 21 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Tuesday, the 31st of July, and we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and the community. I'm Mark, and joining me this week are Alan.
Hello.
And, oh, just Alan then.
Just me. Hello.
Oh, yes. Okay. What's happened to Martin?
We have allowed him to have some holiday time. I know.
We're not paying him enough, are we?
He's allowed some time off from the podcast.
Surely not. I've never heard of such a thing.
Yes. Yes, we've allowed that.
So what have you been up to since our last discussion, also without Martin?
I squeezed in a holiday.
Goodness, that was efficient. Oh, you squeezed it in while we weren't recording. That's yes. Really considerate of you.
Yes, I know, right? I decided to, for my first time ever, I used Airbnb to book a holiday. And I've never used, I've used Airbnb in that I've stayed in a house with you and Laura and Martin when we did Odd Camp, but I didn't
book
it. That
was good fun.
Yes, it was, but I didn't book it, so it wasn't me, and the review didn't, yes. You know, the feedback didn't come back to me. So I have like zero ratings on Airbnb. Yes. But yeah, I booked this house, down in the very, very tippy bottom of Cornwall.
Okay.
The very bottom left-hand bit of
Land's
England.
End.
Yes.
I believe they called it down there.
Like, a place called Senen, S-E-N-N-E-N. Lovely. If you're looking for a nice place to go on holiday that's away from it all, Senen is great. There's loads of lovely walks around there. You're not far from Land's End. You're about 20 minutes away from civilization, and there's some lovely little places nearby. Newquay's not far, Penzance isn't far, St. Michael's Mount, Mousel, some lovely little places around there.
Right.
So I went away with the holiday, with the family. I got a hire car because my rubbish car wouldn't have made it. So we got a hire car, and I got one of these Nissan Qashqai things. It was just whatever the hire company had. And, it had all kinds of technology that I've never had in a car before because I only have old rubbish cars. And it had a camera in it. So for parking, looked down at the camera. Oh, man, it was so good. And a big glass roof. And it was fantastic. It was really, really good.
So how was your Airbnb experience? Did you book like a whole place for the family or were you staying with people?
No, it was a whole house. The guy who owned it was hoping to be there when we arrived, but we had to drive 4.5 hours to get there. And by the time we got there, he sorted out the house, cleaned it from the last tenants and gone back home, to Dorset. So he left a key somewhere for us and we went and it was a lovely house, absolutely perfect, walking distance to the beach, easy access to everything. Had all the facilities, everything we needed, plenty of room for everyone, like everyone spread out. Like myself in one room, wife in another, daughter in another, son in another. Like we couldn't see each other for most of the time.
Bless.
Spend time on holiday together and actually don't spend any time together. It was great. But yeah, it was really, really good. And it was a great first experience of using Airbnb.
I've used it a few times and it's always gone really well. I think everyone I know who uses it sort of regularly, if they go traveling a lot, they all have one really weird story about a place they stayed, but I've fortunately not experienced that yet.
Yeah, my boss uses Airbnb a lot, like for company trips. He uses it all the time. Instead, he I don't remember the last time he stayed in a company booked hotel. He always books his own Airbnb. I think there's some benefit to that, like because it's reduced cost and stuff. So there's some incentive, but yeah, he raves about it, and so I thought, well, I'll give it a go. And my wife found the place, and yeah, it was fantastic. So I definitely consider it because I've never done it before, and I've always been a bit wary of it. But yeah, it worked perfectly. So plus one from me.
Shall we get on with the news?
Shall we?
Now it's time for that news. First up in the news this week, Moodle has ended its partnership with Blackboard.
Oh, I know what Moodle is. What is Blackboard?
So Moodle, for people who don't know, is an open source online learning platform, which is mainly developed by a company called Moodle HQ, who are based in Australia and also a community around the world. Blackboard is their main proprietary closed source competitor.
Oh.
Now, basically, the way that Moodle is funded, well, primarily up until a couple of years ago, it's kind of diversified a bit since then, but primarily the way it was funded was through partner companies. So if companies wanted to sell Moodle services and use the Moodle name, they paid a proportion of their revenue to Moodle HQ to fund the ongoing development of core Moodle. And what happened, I can't remember how long ago, about 2012, Blackboard decided that as well as selling its own learning management system, would buy some of the Moodle partner companies. So they've been also selling Moodle services and therefore part funding Moodle, which was a bit of an interesting situation for a while. And it did lead to some confusion that because the main company they bought was called Moodle Rooms because they'd licensed the name. So that led to some confusion that Blackboard had bought Moodle, which wasn't quite what happened. But now they've decided that they'd rather not be taking money from Blackboard as their competitor, because I guess it seems like a bit of a conflict of interest.
Was it just that? There wasn't any indication there was any underhand things going on. They just didn't like the idea of someone else having influence?
I'm not sure if there was more to it, if there were any sort of particular incidents. I know that in some countries there's been some weird stuff going on, like Moodle conferences being run by competing companies. But I don't know if Blackboard was involved in that. But just been a bit of a strange situation. And now that Moodle has money from other places, well, maybe it can be a bit more picky about who it partners with.
Isn't that normal, though, that for a community thing, anyone can set up an event? Or is that not the case with Moodle?
No, I mean, it's been the case with Moodle up until this point, certainly. I think it's just that it was sort of completely unrelated to any of the Moodle partners. So in fact, it probably wasn't anything to do with Blackboard, thinking about it that way. So it was essentially someone setting up a thing for Moodle people to then try and sell them on another product. But it's kind of interesting to think about sort of how, you know, how we think about whether we're comfy taking money from different people. I mean, there's always when some people join things like the Linux Foundation and the Apache Foundation, particularly when Microsoft started doing it and other companies which were previously seen as bad or whatever, you know, whether we just want any money we can get into our projects and it's all good, as long as there's no particular strings attached, which, you know, in these cases there doesn't seem to be.
Well, the old beggars can't be choosers, you know. Wants to throw a bag of money at you but you don't like, you know, if a cigarette company wants to throw money at your project, you know, and you don't want to be associated with things like that, or, you know, and where your moral compass is determines whether you're willing to take that money, but also how far you are, how close you are to poverty also determines whether you're going to accept that money. And I can imagine that's very difficult for open source projects to turn down money, and they have to internally justify. I'm sure open source projects all around the world turn down donations from people all the time if they don't feel they can morally do it. I've never been in that position. I've certainly, as a contractor, been looking for work and turned down work for companies that I didn't morally want to work for. Yeah. But if it got to the point where I needed to put food on the table, I can see how I'd like to hope I didn't compromise my morals and not and choose a dodgy company, as it were, to work for. But luckily, I never had to be in that position. Although some might say the fact that I worked for Canonical means I did. moving on. Another application delivered via an online store has been found to contain sneaky cryptocurrency mining, would you believe?
Oh,
it's like almost a weekly event that this happens. And
yes. Which store is it this time?
The interesting thing is it's a completely different one this time than it was last time. So previously we've had something in the Snap store. We've had something in NPM. Yeah. This week it's a Steam game.
Oh, okay.
Something that actually it's pretty cunning, because, you know, games often consume a lot of CPU while they're running. So you might be able to mask and hide in plain sight, consuming the end user's CPU in order to, I don't know, render some things on the screen. But actually what you're doing is mining Monero or whatever.
Yes, so that is quite a cunning place to hide it, because you're kind of expecting there to be some load on your GPU, aren't you? And you're probably not going to be thinking, you know, well, you're going to be playing the game. You're not going to be sitting there watching your system resources unless you're a particular kind of gamer.
Right. And I guess it depends on the game as to whether it stands out or not. You know, if it's some simple match three, you know, 2D game, you might be wondering why all of your cores and your GPU is running at full tilt. You know, but if you were clever, then maybe.
So what sort of game was this then?
It's a 2D platform game called Abstractism.
Okay.
And it was removed from Steam, and the reason cited was shipping unauthorized code. So, yeah, while it was running, it did appear to use more CPU and GPU than the simple graphics that the game would normally do.
So was it proven that it was actually crypto mining?
I believe so, which the developers have said, no, it wasn't. Right.
But someone else said, yes, it was, and we believe them.
Well, the fact that it contained a binary called steamservice.exe was a bit interesting.
Yeah.
And we've seen this before. The app that was in the Snap Store that did this
Did
was
the same
called System
thing,
D.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So, I mean, I shouldn't laugh because, you know, these are nefarious things that shouldn't be, you know, made available. But it's quite hilarious to me. This is not new, hiding programs named as something common.
That's, you know, spyware 101, isn't it?
Yes, totally. And back in, I think, 1994, I don't know, were you born then? Probably.
I was playing on my Amiga 500.
Oh, wow. I was a sysadmin at a college, and I was always fighting the students, technologically, cyber warfare.
Okay. Oh, yes.
As we were trying to, prevent access to, damage the computers. And, you know, we would hide things called, command.com or whatever, you know, try and hide things in plain sight. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting that I guess, really, we need to predict what the next software delivery system is going to be that's going to have a sneaky crypto miner in. Write in if you have
an idea. I would say there's got to be some in Android, but I suppose doing it on a phone is going to be of limited benefit, isn't it?
Right, and easily spotted as well.
Yeah, someone's going to notice it burning a hole through their trousers.
But also, Android now tells you when applications are consuming more resources than they... I get this when sometimes Telegram consumes a lot of resources on a phone, and it will say this... You get a notification pop up that tells you this application is using a lot of resources and maybe draining your battery. So that's a welcome addition to Android recently.
Cool.
What's next?
Next up, Firefox has some new logos in the works.
Ooh.
So we're all familiar with the orange... Fiery Fox on the globe icon, which we've had for a long time now, since version 0.8 it was, I believe, when it actually became called Firefox.
Right.
And I think that's about when they developed the logo for it.
Okay. And what's the new logo?
So at the moment, there's two, they're calling them systems of logos, one of which it's been pointed out, the main sort of brand icon looks quite a lot like the GitLab logo.
Yeah.
In that it's an orange fox's head that is a sort of origami folded paper kind of design. I think you'd be forgiven for getting the two confused. But the others are they're a bit more abstract than the existing logo, but the browser icons follow the same kind of they're recognizable as Firefox browser logos. And then there's some other logos for things around Firefox which go with it to try and give you a feel for the kind of visual theme that they're going for. They've said that none of these are actual final icons which they're going to use for anything. They're just sort of soliciting feedback from the community what they think of them at the moment.
It seems like they've done the usual thing that designers often do, which is provide you with one really beautiful set of icons and another one that looks a bit so everyone goes yes I choose A in the Coke versus Pepsi thing. Everyone chooses A because B is intentionally looks a bit rubbish.
I got the feeling, I was looking at the two and I thought, well, I like, you know, this half of set B and this half of set A, and then I scrolled down to the comments and saw a whole bunch of people saying exactly the same thing I was thinking, which was quite good. But we'll see. Yeah, as they say, this isn't actually a set of icons which exists for use at the moment. It is just kind of like a visual mock-up of the concept for now. So if you have thoughts on this, I'm sure Mozilla would be welcoming of your constructive criticism.
Yeah. It's not like they didn't ask for your fully informed reckon.
Yes, they did say they are not crowdsourcing and there will not be a vote.
Okay. Well, it's good that they do this in the open and, you know, let people have some input. It's always nice to get feedback from people who have opinion, I guess. Next up, Krita, popular open source illustration and image editing tool, has removed links to their source code from their Windows Store listing. What?
Yes.
So the store listing, yes. So if a user goes and opens the Windows Store on a Windows machine and types Krita, they would see an icon, screenshots, and then a bit of metadata, like what it does and how it works, and then a link that says, oh, and this is open source, and here's a link to the source code, right? That's yes. what you would expect to see.
Yes, and but it also has a button saying, buy this for $10.
Right. Oh, it's for sale.
It's for sale in the Windows Store, and they also have a link there saying, or had a link there saying, you could download it for free on our website, and here's the source code. But Microsoft said that they are in breach of one of the terms of the store, which says you're not allowed to promote or distribute software except through the Windows Store in an app. Their counter argument to this was that if you read where that is in the terms and conditions, it's under a heading that says if you offer in-app purchases in your app, then your app is not allowed to do this. Apparently,
so what is it they're objecting to? The fact that it links to the source code or the fact that it links to a place where you can get a build that isn't in the store?
I think it's either of them. The fact that they're basically promoting distribution of the software through a means other than the Windows Store, be that as source code or as a build on their website.
Mm.
That's what they're saying is not allowed. But I mean, it depends on how you interpret the rules. If you read that rule in itself, then maybe. But if you read it with the heading above it, then because Krita isn't selling in-app purchases through the app and it's not promoting the free builds in the app, it's in the Windows Store listing, then you could say that there's no reason for them to have to do it. But
right.
Yes. Apparently their appeal was not upheld when they made these points.
These stores really aren't designed for free software developers to put their software in these stores. No. They whenever the lawyers and, you know, the store admins and the store product managers come up with the terms and conditions, they're really primarily thinking of, you know, proprietary applications in that proprietary store. Like unreasonable. It's not unreasonably so because the whole platform is proprietary, but
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft is now publishing open source apps. Some of the stuff that Microsoft publishes in the Windows Store probably has the source code available somewhere.
Well, Ubuntu is in the Microsoft Store.
Well, yes. Well, yeah, I mean, you could say that Ubuntu on Windows promotes software distribution through Apt and
Wget
and
curl and PyPy yes. and npm,
but it doesn't offer in-app purchases, so that shouldn't be a problem.
Really,
I don't know, because Ubuntu on Windows you could buy stuff through Apt on Ubuntu on Windows.
Yeah, not using the versions that are in that store. No. Interesting.
Anyway, yes, we may hear more about this, or that may be the end of it, because, you know, Krita's a small project and Microsoft is one of the biggest companies in the world, sadly. So that's where these things tend to end.
Yeah. Interesting. Is that all the news?
It is. And now it's time for the community news and events. And I'm afraid we've got some sad news to start the community news this week, because Gervase Markham of Mozilla has unfortunately died.
Yeah, I had no idea. When I saw this on Twitter, I had no idea he'd been battling cancer for many years. I've never worked with Gervase and never really interacted with him other than attending a talk he gave at Lug Radio Live in Wolverhampton many, many years ago.
Yeah.
I think where he went through a program he'd written on a BBC Micro And he walked through the source code for this program.
I might have seen that talk as well, actually, yes.
It was really, really entertaining. I really enjoyed that.
Was that he'd found, this is like one which he wrote when BBC Micros were like a normal thing, and he'd found this app.
Yes.
Yes, I do remember that talk as well, yeah.
Yeah, it was very entertaining.
Yeah. Yes, so, I accosted him at FOSDEM after he was doing a talk on his he was in the sort of coordinator in Mozilla for Google Summer of Code for a long time, and I was working on a similar project to Google Summer of Code, so I had a quick chat with him, and he gave me some really useful advice, even though it wasn't any use to him. So I was very grateful for his input there. He was a very, very nice guy and very helpful, and just the kind of person we want more of in the open source community.
Mm-hmm. Next up, Ubuntu 18.04.1 LTS is out.
Hooray!
Yes, hooray indeed. So this is it looks like a minor milestone, the 0.1 release. You know, it's just a roll up of all the updates that have happened since 18.04 came out in April. So if you download the ISO, you're not in much of a different position than you were if you installed 18.04 and did all your updates. There is a couple of interesting things to note, though. This is the point at which upgrade prompts appear for people running the previous LTS, 16.04.
Yeah.
So if you're running 16.04, around about now, you'll get a pop-up that says, yo, 18.04.1 is out. Do you want to upgrade? And you can press the button. Or you could do a clean install if you wanted to. But it's that point that we prompt people once the point release comes out. Right. And the other thing that I think is interesting is, you remember 18.04 had the metrics enabled by default.
Yes.
After the install to like give some data to Canonical about your system. Yeah. Well, actually, that was broken in 18.04. Not completely broken, just a little bit broken, in that it doesn't always detect GPUs correctly. So if you installed from the original 18.04 ISO, then some of that metric data is a bit screwy that we've got. It's not got good GPU data. Some of the strings aren't you know, great. So they don't report what type of GPU it is. So if people upgrade to 18.04.1 or install 18.04.1, then we'll get better data about, if they optionally choose to send it, we'll get better data about the GPUs.
Yeah.
And there's a whole load of other stuff, security updates and other stuff.
Right. Next up, the UK's National National Cyber Security Centre has published some security tips for Ubuntu 18.04.
They've done this before, haven't they, for previous releases, I think.
They've certainly done it for other consumer operating systems. So there's Windows and Android and so on. What I was reading suggested this was the first time it had been done for Ubuntu, but I'm pretty sure I've seen
something like this before. But it's great. It's great to see, information from a trusted source, in inverted commas.
You're right. There is one for 16.04 as well.
Right. So what kind of tips are in here?
So this is about things like enabling VPNs for remote access securely, improving your passwords using a PAM password quality module, various other things to sort of lock down your computer when you're not using it. Apparently they suggest only installing snaps from the Snap Store so that you're not just pulling random bits of software down, and I guess you're running everything confined as much as possible. It seems like they've got some good tips there. Then they don't sort of say, oh, everyone running Ubuntu should use these, but it's like, if you want to if you have specific security considerations, then these are things that you as an end user can do to improve your own security, which is good.
Nice.
Yes,
that's really good to see.
Yes.
Finally, in the community news, the community theme is now called Yaru. It has a name, and it's no longer the weirdly unpronounceable community theme.
I thought it was pronounced communa theme. This is why they changed it.
Yeah, totally. So it's now called Yaru, which we got a hint that was going to happen when we interviewed the guys behind the community theme a little while back. but now it's got a name. So that's good.
Excellent.
I think that's all of the community news.
Okay. Well, we have a few events. We have Academy 2018. That's happening on the 11th to the 17th of August in Vienna, Austria. So what's Academy?
It's a week-long conference for the KDE community. There's 2 days of talks.
Is that how long it takes to get through all of the settings?
Oh, meow. So it's 2 days of talks, Saturday and Sunday, and then 5 days of BOF sessions, Birds of a Feather sessions, and coding sessions.
Oh, cool.
So it's an opportunity for people who work on the KDE platform and KDE applications and people in general who work on Qt stuff to get together. And I might be going to this. I'm not sure yet.
Okay.
Mm.
Well, if you're there, you might see Alan.
Mm.
Next up, Debian's 25th birthday is happening in August, and there are celebration meetups in lots of places.
Mm. Yeah, and I saw this from Chris Lamb. He suggested the UK do a Debian Day celebration for that 25th anniversary on the 16th of August. And I thought it was a UK-only thing, and I clicked the link, and there's a bunch of events that have been scheduled all around the world. Brazil, Italy, Mexico, Sweden, and, of course, the UK. So look out for one, and if there isn't one scheduled, then you could schedule one near you.
And finally, we have Og Camp, which is happening on the 18th and 19th of August. So if you're going to Academy, it's the weekend after.
Ah, yes.
It's in Sheffield in the UK. I think if you're following the Twitter feed, you'll be seeing announcements about the various scheduled speakers. Of course, there will be two unscheduled tracks as well. If you want to come along and talk about anything that you think might interest the community. And if you're bringing young people, there is a Coda Dojo being run for them as well. So go to ogcamp.org and get your tickets. And of course, there'll be t-shirts and mugs for sale to help support the event. I've seen the designs for them and they're looking good.
Awesome.
Yes. Sponsored by Entroware, the Og Camp community, Ubuntu supported by Canonical and OpenSUSE. And that's all the events.
Are you listening to us on our Roku channel? Help other Roku users find the Ubuntu podcast and learn more about open source by giving our channel a star rating.
And that's all for episode 21. We'll be back next week where we'll be talking about the Linux community and are they all horrible people or can we all be nice to each other? We'll also have some command line love and we'll go over your feedback. And yes, that's about it.
Yeah. So, no Martin again next week, I don't think.
No, sadly not. Don't worry, we'll get him back. His contract is irrevocable.